Our next speaker probably does not need much of an introduction, but because he's one of the coolest, I'm going to talk him up a little bit. Jameson Lopp has been building multi-signature Bitcoin wallets for the past 4 years, started out at BitGo, and now is the Chief Technology Officer at Casa. He's a regular on crypto Twitter and Medium, where he distills these complex issues and complex mechanisms for a wider audience. I know this conference is a technical conference. I know the last session was a lot. I know he has memes in his presentation, so this is going to be a little bit fun. So just sit tight, and please help me welcome Jameson Lopp.
All right. So to get started, for those of you who might want to play around a little bit, I would recommend, we'll have a quick demonstration about halfway through where we're going to be playing around with the Electrum wallet. If you have a laptop available, then feel free to go to electrum.org, download the wallet, and then the only tricky part will be figuring out how to run it on testnet. If you're running on Linux or Mac, it should be pretty easy to just pass a dash dash testnet. I think if you're running on Windows, you might have to either get on the command line and run it there, or like create a shortcut where you're passing those additional arguments into it. But I imagine you'd be able to figure out how to do it by the time we get to that point. So, why are we here? Well, I've been doing Bitcoin full-time for about 5 years now. I've been building infrastructure for multi-sig wallets, both in the enterprise setting and in the individual setting. And I've seen people screw up in more ways than I could ever really imagine. And it's simply because there are so many foot guns available in this really complex protocol and in all of the applications that are being built on top of it, that people can lose money in a variety of different ways, probably countless ways. I mean, I've seen people manage to turn multi-signature wallets into what are effectively single-signature wallets. I've seen people get frustrated by inconvenient security features and turn them off and then get hacked. And I've met countless individuals over the years who have chosen to leave their crypto assets with a trusted third-party custodian because they simply don't trust themselves to set up a hardware wallet or to set up cold storage that is sufficiently robust. So the main thing that I've really learned over the years is that users need guardrails. Like, we need to build software in a way that has a lot of the best practices that are a part of the software itself, that try to basically save the user from these foot guns. One example for what I've seen, especially on the enterprise side of completely new companies getting into Bitcoin, is, you know, we make APIs available to them for enterprise wallets, and I've lost count of how many new companies I've seen start up their API and then just start sending like 100 transactions per second, because they simply didn't know, you know, the throughput limits that the Bitcoin blockchain makes available to them. And I've seen plenty of other examples of developers basically hard coding fees to a 0.0001 per transaction amount because they didn't know anything about weight. They didn't know anything about fee management. I've also seen users not even understand anything about UTXOs and end up getting themselves in bad situations, and we'll talk about a number of these things in more depth. From a security standpoint, you know, it's very easy to achieve a high level of security for your private keys. All you have to do is throw them away so that nobody can access them. Of course, there's some trade-offs here. It's also very easy to achieve a high degree of usability for your private keys. You just create a web page, and anyone who accesses that web page can spend the private keys. Of course, it's not great from a security standpoint. Now, non-custodial wallets, give up a lot of control over the wallet operation itself and hand that control, that freedom, to the user. And they do that in order to provide a stronger security model for the user. They're basically trying to help fulfill the promise of Bitcoin that anyone can be their own bank. But of course, the trade-off is now the user needs to have more knowledge, needs to understand the best practices of both security and privacy and a number of other things in order to prevent themselves from basically shooting themselves in the foot. So if we're just like thinking about private keys, for example, I'm specifically looking at like single key versus multi-signature wallets. There's a number of different risks that you have to worry about. So if you're just doing a simple single signature wallet, you're basically putting all of your eggs in one basket. There's a number of things that can go wrong. Malware could get on that machine, steal everything. You know, someone could hack it. There might be a weak password securing it that gets brute forced. There are issues with inheritance and death and basically who can access that wallet if the primary accessor is no longer able to. There's plenty of issues, of course, ultimately with coercion of that wallet owner. But then if there's a single key and it's held by a third-party service, say some sort of enterprise API provider, then you have a lot of the same issues, but you also have to worry about insider theft. You have to worry about any number of things that could go wrong with the company, such as lying to you about how solvent they are, or potentially becoming an attack from some greater authority, such as law enforcement. What we ended up doing over the years is figuring out like how do we separate these concerns and end up with a more robust system, and we basically ended up with something like this, where the user themselves has multiple keys in a multi-sig arrangement, and then the service only holds one key. So the service cannot really be a bad actor in and of themselves. They no longer have the ability to fully create or fully block a transaction if the user really wants to. But by holding one key, they can help facilitate certain things. By separating these risks, we can get rid of a lot of problems like malware or a single insider who goes bad or gets coerced, because you basically need to have sign-off now from multiple people who have different interests at heart. And ultimately, with a system like this, the only things that are still left are some sort of coercion or some sort of phishing. Basically, phishing, I best describe that as like brain hacking. And I think at the end of the day, like no type of technological security system will ever make you foolproof against the hacking of the brains of the people who are ultimately controlling the technical system. That's something that's always going to be ongoing and a battle that never really ends. But if you are doing some sort of management where there are hot keys involved, for example, BitGo is a system where it's two of three. BitGo has one key themselves, but those keys are kind of online because they are being used to essentially decide whether or not to co-sign on transactions by applying arbitrary policies that the user sets to basically lock down their system from a security standpoint. If you are setting up a system like that, preferably, you should, once again, use dedicated hardware. So HSMs, you can get HSMs from a number of different providers like Gemalto, I believe Ledger has an HSM. There are also virtualized HSMs that providers like Amazon Web Services make available, where at the very least you can put one more level of security between a hacker and the private keys. It's still not foolproof because there must be some way to access that HSM and sign off on transactions. But digging a little bit more deeper into just the way that wallets work, hopefully you're at least aware that in Bitcoin, there's no such thing as an actual Bitcoin. All you have are transaction outputs. And those transaction outputs are either spent or unspent. And it's the unspent transaction outputs that have the value that contain the quote-unquote bitcoins. So it turns out that when you're doing an enterprise-level wallet, you're going to have potentially a lot of UTXOs to manage. Your average individual, you know, even if they're making a transaction a day, they're probably not going to end up with a ton of UTXOs. But a payment processor or an exchange or some service that may have hundreds of thousands of users, they can potentially have a wallet fill up with a large number of UTXOs, far more UTXOs than can be spent in a single transaction. In many cases, far more UTXOs than can even be spent in a single block or in a number of blocks back to back. Like, you're starting to run up against these global throughput issues once again. But there's also a variety of considerations that you have to take when it comes to figuring out how are you going to spend these UTXOs. And this is a problem that has no single specific solution because it depends on what you as a service are trying to optimize for. You might be trying to optimize for privacy and, you know, trying to keep UTXOs unlinked. You might be optimizing for minimizing like the amount of data that you're creating with your transactions and basically spending the fewest number of UTXOs as possible. You also might be trying to, you know, minimize your transaction fees of what is the actual amount and level of money that has to be spent to get these transactions confirmed. And there are a number of other considerations that also might have to go into. It really comes down to what the spending patterns, the spend and receive patterns of these wallets are going to be. And if you're creating an enterprise level wallet that is just for you as one company, then hopefully you can analyze what those spending patterns are and optimize for them. A company that's like BitGo, which is actually providing enterprise services to a variety of other companies, gets even more complicated because each of those users has their own unique spending patterns, and as a result, specific things that they need to be worried about over the long term with regard to managing these UTXOs. So the actual UTXO selection problem in computer science is referred to as the knapsack problem, simply because there's usually multiple solutions to, you know, how do you construct a transaction that selects enough UTXOs to get the target value. And we've seen some pretty in-depth research occur in this space. For example, Mark Erhart, who is now an engineer at BitGo, did an entire master's thesis on how to optimize UTXO selection, and specifically has worked that towards trying to minimize creating change outputs, which is good both for the UTXO, like blockchain bloat, and good for privacy. So there's something that I basically refer to as the Goldilocks zone, and this is, once again, coming down to like the spending and receiving patterns of any given Bitcoin wallet. And one problem that we saw quite often was having far too many UTXOs. Often this would occur with payment processors who were receiving, you know, $5, $10, $20 payments for retail level items. And the problem that these payment processors would run into is that eventually they would want to go make a withdrawal from the wallet, and due to the sheer number of UTXOs, they would find it could potentially cost them a significant portion of the value in those UTXOs, depending upon things like the fee market and basically how many other people were trying to create Bitcoin transactions at that time. So, you know, one thing that we recommended to these providers is that they start to look at like the actual economics behind UTXOs, understanding that it is going to cost some range to re-spend that money, and making some predictions around, you know, what is the minimum amount that's probably going to cost, what is the maximum amount, and therefore, what do we think an economically spendable or economically viable UTXO will even be? If it doesn't make sense, or if it's going to cost you, you know, around a dollar to spend a UTXO, then does it even make sense to be accepting deposits for less than a few dollars or even $10? You know, what is your own margin? What is your profit margin? And what can you actually afford? You should really be building that into your own business model with regard to accepting Bitcoin. Thankfully, of course, these days we have other options like Lightning, which we can point people towards if they want to accept smaller value payments. There's also the issue of not having enough UTXOs. Normally, this would happen with newer customers who they would create their wallet, they would fund it with like one transaction from an old wallet, and then they would just go to town, start spending, you know, allowing withdrawals, sending money over and over again. And ultimately, what would happen is they would start creating these long chains of unconfirmed transactions. Now, that becomes a problem because once you get to a certain point, Bitcoin nodes on the network consider these long unconfirmed transaction chains to be kind of spammy, and they will stop relaying those transactions around the network. And so what we actually ended up doing was adding in some additional logic to our SDKs and to our wallets to basically figure out, you know, what is the target number of good, healthy UTXOs for this wallet given its spending patterns. And if we're well under that target, we actually create multiple change outputs when you create a transaction to try to get the number of confirmed UTXOs back to a decent number, because we want to avoid having a ton of unconfirmed change UTXOs in your wallet. That just leads you down the path of creating those chains, and that's when you end up with people trying to withdraw money and send transactions, and then they'll often get a success message that the transaction was created, but then they go look on block explorers, they look in their wallet, and it doesn't show up. And that ends up creating a lot of support burden for us as an organization. So if you have, you know, just the right number of UTXOs, then you should be able to spend almost, you know, the entire value of your wallet at any given time, but also be able to spend smaller amounts of value without basically creating a huge change output that could make it tricky for you to spend a larger value during the same time period before your current unconfirmed transactions get confirmed. So transaction fee estimation is a pretty complicated, crazy thing in and of itself. A lot of us spent, I think, a decent portion of 2017 and early 2018 kind of trying to put out fires with regard to transaction fee estimates. This is a chart not of recommended transaction fee estimates, but of divergence of recommended transaction fee estimates between different APIs. And the main point being that I think the green line is like next block or two blocks, and then the other ones are further out, like three, four, five, six block estimates. And you can see that at least when we're talking about transaction fee estimates for one or two blocks from now, it's all over the place as to what different estimate algorithms are going to provide. And that basically kind of shows the immaturity of this like fee estimate algorithm at a global scale. So there's at least, I want to say, eight, maybe a dozen different publicly available fee estimate APIs out there. Recommend making use of multiple ones of them, because sometimes one or two will just go completely haywire. And I think the best way to look at it is if you're not going to dig into the weeds and build your own fee estimate from scratch, you should use at minimum at least 3 fee estimate algorithms. That way, you know if one goes completely haywire, you can basically have some sort of consensus going on within fee estimates. Even like looking at, this is really more looking at the patterns of demand for block space. If you get really deep into the weeds of fee estimates and you want to start getting past being reactive and being proactive, then you start to look at things like day of week and time of day of when there's going to be more demand for block space because people are awake, people are making transactions. While I did not get to the point of trying to bake that into my like real-time fee estimate algorithms, we did use the sort of off-peak demand hours to recommend that our clients who had way too many UTXOs basically run UTXO consolidation functions and be able to put out these transactions with very, very low fee rates because they didn't really care how long it took for them to get confirmed, because all they were trying to do is to get their UTXOs back into a healthy, spendable number within their wallet. And there is no perfect way of doing fee estimates because you're basically trying to predict the future based upon trailing data, possibly, if you're more sophisticated, based on current mempool unconfirmed transaction data, but you still don't know what's going to happen with the mempool, you know, with over the next block or so. So the simplest way to solve this, if it's possible for your wallet, is to use replace by fee. That way, if there is some sudden spike in demand and your unconfirmed transactions look like they're not going to get confirmed for a long time, then you can just bump them. You basically re-sign them with a slightly higher fee, and you can actually adjust them as the demand for block space changes. Unfortunately, RBF is not really very easy to do with multisig because you have to do one of two things. You have to either pre-sign a lot of transactions up front and then hold them in reserve and broadcast them as needed, or you need to keep going back and bugging someone or some user to sign new updated versions of the transaction with the bumped fee. If you want to get a little more efficient, then you can actually take RBF to the next level, and if you have multiple transactions that are unconfirmed, you can actually repackage them into one, which will give you even greater fee savings because you'll be having fewer number of inputs and signatures you're putting out there. But my biggest takeaway from fee estimates in general that I think a lot of developers in the space have made kind of a tactical error is that default values for anything are very sticky, and to my knowledge, like pretty much every wallet out there has default fee estimate values that are very aggressive, that are like in the next 2 or 3 blocks. And I think that a lot of the software out there is not even asking the users, you know, do you really care how long it takes to get this transaction confirmed? I think that developers are often assuming that users are impatient, and that is resulting in us actually creating these kind of feedback effects with the fee market, because a lot of people are just blasting transactions out there without even, you know, thinking about, do I really want to pay this much? Do I really care if it gets confirmed in the next X number of blocks? So just making dialogues more in the user's face, where we get a little more human input into these markets, I think will make the markets more organic and less spiky due to being kind of artificially changed via strong, sticky defaults from developers. And so I talked for a second about send queue management and how you might use something like replace by fee to like repackage your unconfirms. But there are a number of issues with sending Bitcoin transactions that are not obvious at first. And that's because a valid Bitcoin transaction is not necessarily going to make its way around the network. I tried to kind of show a graph here where it's very easy to check whether or not a transaction, like a signed Bitcoin transaction, is valid, once you have signed it. There are libraries that will check for that. Very easy. However, the next question is this transaction considered standard by the policies of most of the nodes on the network? And there are things that can result in a transaction being considered non-standard, such as the size. For example, if it's larger than 100 kilobytes or whatever the corresponding transaction weight to that is, then it's going to get rejected by pretty much every node out there. And so if that happens, you're going to end up with a valid transaction that your software thinks is good, and the wallet is just sitting there saying, yeah, everything's good, we're just waiting for it to be confirmed. But then after some period of time, when it doesn't get confirmed, the user is inevitably going to go start looking at block explorers, and they're not going to see the transaction in any block explorers, and they're going to start freaking out. And then you, once again, have to get support involved and have to figure out, why is this Bitcoin transaction not existing on the network? Even taking it one step further, it's possible to have a transaction that is standard and conforms to most of these policies, but still does not get relayed around the network. One example for that would actually be due to the minimum relay fee on nodes. And nodes protect themselves in a variety of different ways from what they consider to be denial of service attacks. One of those being, the fact that a node is a machine that has a limited amount of memory, and if the mempool gets too full of too many transactions, the node will actually start dropping and refuse to relay transactions that are below a certain threshold, because the assumption is basically, well, these transactions aren't going to get confirmed anytime soon anyways, because there's so many more basically in the queue ahead of it. And so this actually throws another wrench in the loop of understanding whether or not a transaction is able to get relayed across the network. So this is basically a dynamically changing value. The vast majority of the time, the value is set at, like one Satoshi per byte or whatever. But during extreme times of congestion, this value can go all over the place. So, what are you going to do? I mean, the main point with all of this is that you need to be proactively monitoring the state of unconfirmed transactions in your send queue by querying a variety of different nodes to make sure those nodes have received and relayed that transaction. And you may even want to take it a step further and try to be more proactive, understanding what these various policies are so that you can check for them before you even try to broadcast a transaction in the first place. Another issue with the enterprise wallets is being able to support querying the data in these wallets, whether that is wallet balances and address balances, transaction history, UTXOs. The needs change significantly between an individual wallet where it's probably okay for you to just scan through the blockchain via SPV one time and you're good, because once you get to the tip, you just keep asking other nodes once in a while if anything new has happened. But with enterprise wallets, you're going to end up with a lot more data, potentially with a lot of data put into single buckets. Like, you might have an address that's getting reused a ton of times and has a ton of other data associated with it. This is actually one of the reasons why a lot of enterprises will end up using a third-party API provider like BitGo, is because they actually find it's just too challenging to set up all of the infrastructure to be able to serve queries quickly, whereas a company that specializes in this, like BitGo, already has a ton of infrastructure set up, and they can basically respond to any arbitrary query in a matter of milliseconds due to all of the indexes that are slicing and dicing this data up. So One fun fact is that I actually crashed the entire BitGo infrastructure one time because I made a bad call. I made a single API call against a single address that had something like tens of thousands of transactions and addresses associated with it. And that just resulted in a cascading failure of database timeouts and then web server timeouts and ultimately like all the threads in the web server locked up, and BitGo as a platform just went completely unresponsive until we figured that out. And so like this is the type of thing that can happen if you aren't properly indexing data and you're running complex queries against it. And indexing blockchains can actually be a bit trickier than most other data that's like less structured, and that's just due to the dependencies in all of it. You know, you've got inputs and outputs going through it, the entire chain of transactions. And I spent several years enhancing and then completely rewriting the indexing services at BitGo, and you know, there was always more room to like squeeze performance out of it. Ultimately, this is a problem for a number of reasons, because the blockchain only continues increasing in size, which means that your indexing service is probably going to get slower and slower and slower with regard to doing the initial build. So you're probably going to want to have multiple indexing services running simultaneously so that if one gets corrupted, something goes wrong, you can fail over and then slowly rebuild the corrupt service. In reality, like UTXOs and stuff end up being a lot more complicated, and a more naive indexing service that is trying to be performant or trying to do things in parallel can very easily run into deadlock-style situations. That was one of the biggest issues that I dealt with during my time at BitGo, was trying to balance parallelizing ingestion of blockchain transactions versus the inevitable like deadlock and dependency issues that they could cause. So ultimately, I ended up having a service that would process one block at a time, and then it would look at all of the transactions in that block, find all of the dependent transactions, kind of put them each in their own queue to work on separately, and then throw all of the other transactions at a multi-threaded executor that would just run through them as quickly as possible. And while there is a lot of challenge of doing that and doing the initial sync because it just takes so long, what I found from a complexity standpoint and where most of my code was spent was actually with dealing with the real-time stuff, with indexing unconfirmed transactions or with indexing the tip of the chain, which then might get reorganized and might result in having to revert a lot of data and then re-index it, and sometimes having conflicts between the previous state and the new state. And reorganizations are a pretty major event on a blockchain. You have to stop everything that you're doing, roll back all of the transactions to a certain point, and then reapply a bunch of new transactions, and then figure out which transactions are left over that are now unconfirmed but still valid and not invalidated. What I found from a robustness standpoint was that running on the Bitcoin testnet was a great stress test. From time to time, we would have these what I call block storms, where a new block would come in almost every second. And then sometimes we would have blockchain reorganizations that were 500 or 1,000 blocks long. And that type of activity would very quickly find any problems in the indexer, often either causing it to completely lock up or crash by running out of memory if there was some inefficiency going on. So if you can survive on testnet, you'll do really well on mainnet. From an address management standpoint, you know, there are privacy issues with reusing addresses. It's very hard to prevent people from reusing it. But more importantly, I think that there should be a cost associated with creating addresses. This is mainly due to issues with hierarchical derivation and the problems that arise when you have large gaps between funded and unfunded addresses in your wallet. If possible, it would be nice for your users to basically be able to take stale, unused addresses and put them back in a queue to kind of put them, make them available for not really for reuse, but for use in the first place. This becomes a big issue when we're talking about wallet recovery. Walletsrecovery.org actually was a new project that just came out a week or so ago, which will help you understand how, despite the fact that we have a lot of quote-unquote standards in this space, the way that a lot of wallets work is not the same. And that has basically resulted in us now having to document a lot of the differences. It is very difficult if you have a wallet that stops working to then just go import it into another wallet. There may be very subtle differences that cause them not to be compatible with each other, usually around things like derivation and scripts. Now, one thing that I've run into a lot, actually, is something that I think is worth trying to show to you today. If anyone has an Electrum wallet open, you can go to the tiny URL here, tinyurl.com/y5frxlxy, and that basically has this VPUB, which is an extended public key for a testnet wallet. And what you can do if you set up a new Electrum wallet, and let me see if I can actually show this to you. Womp, womp, womp. Say we want to create a new wallet over here, and this is asking, you know, what type of wallet do we want? Well, I don't know if that is legible, but we want the standard wallet, which is the first option. And then the next question will say, you know, what do you want to do with your seed? Well, it's kind of oddly named, but we want the third option, that is use a master key. So once you select use a master key, then it's going to ask for you to basically paste this extended public key in. And once you do that, it's going to start searching for the funds that are related to that public key. And what you're probably going to see, and hopefully this is readable, is something like this. You see like two different transactions, and we're currently finding a balance of something like almost 51 testnet Bitcoin on there. But what if I told you there's actually a lot more Bitcoin in this wallet? So, you know, what happened to it? Where did it go? This is the problem with the address gap limit, which is a standard in one of the BIPs. I believe the default address gap is something like 20 derivations for your receive addresses, and maybe only about 5 for your change addresses. But what we found is that real-world spending patterns for a variety of businesses don't really conform to that limit. There are a number of reasons why exchanges or payment processors may end up creating large gaps of addresses. Basically, they might be creating a lot of users, and those users never make a deposit. They might be creating a bunch of invoices, and the users never pay those invoices. And so you end up with a lot of unfunded addresses, which can be fine as long as you keep using that same wallet and you have all of that data. But if you then have something go wrong and you need to recover using some other software, or even using the same software in the first place, if it needs to scan through the blockchain and find all of those addresses, then you're gonna have a problem if it's not conforming to the defaults. So what we end up actually having to do, and I've had to do this in a variety of cases, is go in to something like Electrum and basically force it to create a ton of addresses. So like we can run a little command here. It's basically a for loop. And we're going to say, generate like 1,000 addresses, and Electrum will automatically, start searching through all of those addresses. We can hear the fan going. And once it generates all of those addresses, it's going to start querying the Electrum servers and say, hey, do you know what's going on? Do any of these addresses have activity? So you see it's synchronizing. Hopefully the Electrum servers are playing nice today on testnet. And I think in this particular case, I had it generate 1,000 addresses. What I had run into in the past was actually with a wallet on testnet, which ended up having a gap of something like 20 addresses. And that occurred as a result of those long chain reorgs that I was talking about. There was basically a chain reorg of like 1,000 blocks or so, and somehow a bunch of my transactions became invalidated, or at the very least, they should have still been valid, but they became unconfirmed and then never got reconfirmed. And then I had other transactions related to addresses that were derived later on that then became confirmed. But of course, with our luck, something's going wrong with the internet. Has anyone else been able to do this? Have you managed?
Pulled up another 50,000 MVCs.
All right. What if I told you there's more? Ah, there we go. Yeah, so it looks like we found like another 50 in there. Okay, so the problem though is that this command, you may have noticed that there is a false that was passed into it. Well, that's because it's telling Electrum to, look and only derive down one specific path. So you can actually do the same thing and pass a true. At least, I hope that worked. It's hard for me to tell. We'll try it again. And that's because it was looking on the receive path, but you also have a change address path. So I think false basically means don't do the receive address, do the change address path. So because it turns out there were also funds on the change address path that were derived further along, it was not looking for those either. And I won't bore you sitting here, looking at it just chug along. But after a while, it's going to derive those addresses, and it's going to continue to find the rest of the funds. And this is an issue that I think not many people have really talked about. One thing that I did notice recently is that BTC Pay Server changed their default to generate, I think, 10,000 addresses. And I'm sure that's because a lot of people were using BTC Pay Server and ended up with very large address gaps. Like, we've had people come along to our store and generate like dozens of addresses, probably just to screw with us. They were generating dozens of invoices that they never paid. So I knew that was going to become a problem eventually. So like I said, use testnet. Lots of bad things happen on testnet, and that's actually good. If you can handle testnet, you can handle anything. There's, like I said, plenty of privacy issues you can also worry about. We won't get into all of those, but there are things that you can do both at the network level to protect privacy, to try to protect like the transaction broadcasting that you're doing from network peers that may be observing you, and of course from the actual management of UTXOs. Data management is a big issue. How do you prevent people from losing data? That's a tough problem. At least from the like password standpoint, we can set really complex password requirements so that we know that they're probably using a generator. There, you can try to disperse some of the trust required by having various key recovery services that keep backups of things. And I think sending health checks and periodic reminders can help. Like I ended up doing a lot of manual work at BitGo, basically looking at wallet UTXOs and emailing our users, telling them about best practices. But a lot of those things could actually be automated and basically send notifications to folks. So I also had a number of things here around Bitcoin fork handling, which is something that I think almost no enterprises saw coming a few years ago. The various forks that came along placed a large load on the enterprises, both philosophically and technically. We had issues with replay protection. We had issues worrying about wipeout protection. We had a lot of address formatting issues of people sending to addresses on the wrong network because they were compatible with each other when preferably they shouldn't have been. And ultimately, so people who got confused between the different coins would create a large load on us having to basically manually recover funds from them. We ended up having to duplicate a lot of our infrastructure to be able to support these other fork coins. And then there were just a lot of WTFs going on. It really kept us on our toes. But, that's the way that environments like this can go, is that, there's no single person making decisions, so crazy stuff can happen that you have to have resources that are available to, work on things that come up at the last minute. I also had fun with Bitcoin Gold because, their node simply wasn't working at first. They were also changing addresses retroactively, so we had to run these scripts across our entire infrastructure to convert addresses over when we wanted to basically allow people to access their airdrops. There was, of course, the 2x, which resulted in us expending a lot of technical energy on something that ended up not happening at all, so that was fun. And then upgrades in general. Upgrades at the network and protocol level, for them to be backwards compatible, is great. People can take their time. But upgrades with our own SDKs became an interesting issue where, we would add SegWit support and we would add better fee estimation stuff, but our users would not, in many cases, would not go out and upgrade. And so, we would actually have to start running our own reports internally so that we could then go bug our customers. And in many cases, they still wouldn't really listen to us. We had to take it a step further and actually write scripts that would explain to our customers how much money they would save if they spend a few hours, upgrading their SDKs to take advantage of efficiencies and optimizations that we had made available. In general, there's a lot of other issues just with users being stupid. There's only so much that you can do to save people from themselves. Though one thing that I did like that we did at BitGo was we went out and we observed a bunch of malware, and we took all of those malware author addresses and we put them into our own database and basically would refuse to co-sign transactions that were going to the malware author addresses. We saved tens of thousands of dollars worth of Bitcoin going to those authors. And, of course, complexity being the enemy of security, you want to take as much of this complexity as possible, shove it under the hood, have it happen automatically so that you don't have to then go bug your users to do the best practices. So I think we're right on time. And I'll be here for the rest of the conference, so feel free to bounce any ideas or questions off of me. Thanks.